On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Counterpoint with Michael Duffy and Paul Comrie Thompson.
Our next guest, Christopher Joy of Rismark International, is not happy. Specifically, he finds it frustrating when economic falsehoods are used to push crummy policies. He found some clangers amongst the submissions to last year's Henry Review of Taxation. Specifically, we should discourage home ownership because, these submissions stated, investing in housing is unproductive. In response to this, he blogged, "Let's set the record straight and banish these silly suggestions." I spoke to Christopher Joy last week. Christopher Joy, why do some economists, we'll call them naysayers, argue that we should discourage home ownership?
Well, there's a common presumption that all forms of investment in housing are unproductive. And that leads various commentators and economists to the conclusion that investing in housing is bad for homeowners, and also lending to housing is bad for banks.
So ideally, in the world of the naysayers, should homeowners become accommodation renters? Is this looked upon as better?
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the perverse conclusions of the argument and the logic that is employed in this debate, that if housing is unproductive and investing in housing is bad, then rental accommodation is, for some, a preferred form of tenure. And now, there's nothing wrong with renting a home, to be clear, but ultimately, somebody has to own those assets.
I'm not an economist. I'm a mere mortal. But this whole argument that renting is better than owning property, that to me has the aroma of Eastern Europe before the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Is there a bit of that ideology filtering around here?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think in the early 20th century, there was a view that the very low rates of home ownership that existed in various Anglo countries were in part responsible for the rise of communism, and home ownership was very much, at that time, I think, a conservative aspiration politically and ideologically. And I think it was Margaret Thatcher in 1979 who coined the term the property-owning democracy, and she privatised a lot of the public housing stock. But again, going back to basics, the key issue here is that the two most important ingredients for a functioning economy we sometimes forget are food and shelter.
I guess the naysayers have forgotten the basics, that without food and without shelter, you're not going to have much productive work going on, are you?
That's right.
Now, you cite a wonderful quotation. It's from a 1964 paper in Land Economics, and it examined the question of the productivity of housing, which is what you've been talking about. I want to quote it here, partly because of the language. "Surely the time has come to assault frontally the shibboleth that housing is unproductive, for this shibboleth is hampering the efforts of all less developed countries," close quote. Wonderful language. You sometimes think that economics is the dismal science. But more than that, the author argues that this attitude discourages a lot of positive economic activity. So what positive activity is squashed by this attitude towards housing?
Well, there's actually a contemporary application. The National Housing Supply Council recently concluded that Australia is short in preferred terms about 200,000 homes. And the shortage of housing in this country, which has also been verified by pretty much every major private economic group, has in fact contributed to the run-up in prices. It's simple demand and supply. If you're constraining the supply of housing with a given level of demand, you're going to push up prices. And one of the reasons we're not producing enough housing in this country is that banks are very concerned about lending to developers. And one of the explanations posited by the banks themselves, NAB, for instance, has been that investment in housing is unproductive, and this is not a good use of capital. Let me add here that we get from housing what are known in the economics lexicon as housing services, and that's shelter. And owning a home and renting it out and providing those housing services to third parties is no different to investing in a factory that's producing shoes or cars and automobiles that we use for transportation. It really is a condition precedent to a viable economy.
So you're getting an economic a positive effect, but you also say, I'm interested in this, housing is an integral part of a functioning community. We don't hear that sort of language much in the current debate, a functioning community. Talk us through that.
Well, I think well-located housing and the quality of the housing itself has been shown empirically to positively influence our own productivity and the productivity of the companies we work for. And the notion of social capital that the Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen paid a lot of attention to in his research, many argue is also inextricably linked to the quality of housing that we have access to. That may mean both rental housing and owner-occupied housing. But to the extent that we price generations out of housing in this country because we're artificially constraining the production and investment and supply of housing, we could, it may be argued, undermine the quality of our communities and the social capital that people have access to.
Now, I'd like to turn to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. A study in 2007 which observed that, and I'm quoting them here, household capital directly affects labour productivity. This sounds intriguing. Can you tell us about that?
Well, they make the point, the authors of that study, that just like we need to repair our factories and maintain our factories, the two critical inputs into any economic process are labour and capital. So you and I as workers and capital, typically being physical capital in the form of machines. And obviously the functionality of your human capital, your people, is also, it would appear, related to the quality of the shelter that they can access. So, for instance, if you're located in great distances from your place of work, you're going to take a long time to commute to that destination. You may be less productive as a result. And furthermore, if you live in, for instance, very poor quality housing. So, for instance, if you think of the very high-density housing that you see in some cities in China, it could be argued that your ability to be a productive member of the economy and the wider community is, relatively speaking, limited. And then finally, to the extent that that housing is proximate to the companies themselves, again, it's been shown through this research that contributes to the company's productivity.
Now, of course, the accelerating work from home trend is important in this whole debate, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is, I think, a bit of a crucial touchstone. Innovations like the National Broadband Network could indeed alleviate a lot of the pressure placed on the need to have closely located or densely packed communities. And if we can leverage off broadband, even though I've publicly, for the ABC, opposed that particular solution and the way in which it's been manufactured, it does hold out the prospect of opening up vast swathes of territories that are located some distances from traditional labour markets so that people can work remotely. And we've found that there's been a substantial increase in the proportion of workers that are spending time at home, from about 20% of all workers in 2000 to around 25% in 2008.
Some dry statistics in your original blog where you aired your thoughts. In 2007-2008, new housing investment directly contributed more than $68 billion to Australia's GDP. The naysayers, they'll look at that, but they'll still say that investing in housing is unproductive.
That's right. It's a very, very important part of the national output. And I think the other point I noted in that piece was that investments in new housing, whilst investments in established housing, that is the resale of existing homes, is actually intrinsically productive because you're providing shelter and accommodation services either to yourself or to a third-party renter, and that's no different to buying a farm and producing fruit and veg and either eating that fruit and veg or selling it at market for others to consume. But investment in new housing's also got what economists call a very high multiplier, and that multiplier is estimated by the ABS to be 2.9 times. What that means is that for every new dollar that we invest in new housing, we generate another $2.9 of additional expenditure that washes through the rest of the economy.
Ever since I've been a small boy, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Melbourne Age and other journals have been saying we're not saving enough in Australia. Is there a positive relation between commitment to housing and individual savings?
Well, Australia actually has a very high household savings rate by international standards. And one of the mistakes people make when they think about savings is they forget to account for the advent of superannuation. So internationally, our savings rate is quite strong. And what is interesting, our savings rate today at about 10% of disposable income is the highest it's been in decades. So there's a new conservatism that has gripped in consumer land, I think, as a function of the global financial crisis. And it is true that, obviously, to the extent that you have little savings, it's going to be harder to purchase housing if you want to own outright. And I think it's also true insofar as Australian households are saving much more than they have before, which is certainly happening right now, and consuming less on a discretionary basis, then affordability in the medium term should improve.
In Australia, we can point to many examples of positive encouragement of home ownership. Now, accepting that we don't want to discourage this, could we be supporting it too much?
Well, the conventional view is we are providing too many subsidies to the housing market, and the most obvious one that folks like to point to is the capital gains tax exemption on the owner-occupied home. The fact of the matter is, though, housing is actually a very heavily taxed, relatively speaking, asset class. I think it was the IMF or OECD a few weeks ago who came out and showed that Australia had the third or fourth highest housing transaction costs in the, it was actually the OECD. And the round-trip transaction costs associated with owning a home are around 13 or 14%, much higher than, for instance, if you want to buy and sell shares. The other thing that people forget, which is crucial, is that whilst we are not taxed on the capital gains on our home, the debt that we use to fund that home is not tax deductible. And that, in the case of owner-occupied housing, is different to any other asset class. So the fact that we don't have tax deductible mortgage debt is the cost or the price we pay for not being levied capital gains tax.
And unlike the United States of America, we can't just walk away from our mortgage debts, can we?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the people who criticise the current tax arrangements around housing would have us levy capital gains tax, and they would presumably have tax deductible mortgage debt. That is exactly what you have in the United States. They have CGT on housing, and they have tax deductible mortgage debt. What that means is people gear up or they leverage up much more in the United States. They hold their debt for a longer period of time because it's tax effective to do so, and then they have, as a consequence, many believe, much higher default rates because households in the US tend to be much more indebted than their Australian equivalents.
Could be in Australia we do it better. Christopher Joy, thanks for talking to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Christopher Joy is the CEO of Rismark International, a global funds management and advisory business, and he was the principal author of the 2003 Prime Minister's Home Ownership Task Force Report. A link to his article, The Housing Productivity Myth, will be posted on the Counterpoint website.